everyone, welcome to Project Unlaced. Today I have a super special guest. We have Megan Hellner. She is a clinician in eating disorder space since 2003, and she holds a dual specialty in both eating disorders and sports nutrition. So thank you so much for joining me today. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. I'm super excited to be here and to be talking to you. Yeah. Yeah.
Awesome. So I think good background knowledge would be like, what drew you into this field of eating disorders and sports nutrition?
Yeah. So I think dating, you know, way back to undergrad, I was interested in nutrition. And the more I learned about nutrition, the less interesting it started to be, to think more about like what to eat, what's good to eat. The food science aspect of it was just not super interesting to me after a while, but eating behavior was very interesting, more of like the how we eat, how do we make decisions around how much to eat? What does that interplay look like between, you know, mental health and eating behavior? That was always more interesting to me. So right out of undergrad, I started working at a local, working with a local eating disorder inpatient program in a PHP. And it was, I kind of knew right away that it was exactly where I needed to be. Many of the other fields of dietetics just weren't going to be, I thought, as challenging and just not as much of a good fit for me. And so several years, maybe 5, 6, 7 years into working in eating disorders, I was seeing a ton of athletes, which was personal to me. I was an athlete as well, or still consider myself one to some degree, recreational athlete. And I started to get this sense that I needed to know a lot more about their sport-specific needs in order to treat them effectively and to just, you know, join with them effectively. From there, kind of fell backwards into working at US University of San Diego, a local private university, as their sports dietitian for a number of years. And at the end of my experience there, I kind of knew, really solidified that this was like the perfect intersection for me working with athletes with disordered eating or REDS.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think this is such an important space, and I know like I'm really passionate as someone who kind of is going through that journey of, yes, I'm an athlete, but I'm also going through eating disorder recovery and learning how to fuel myself. And I think there's just so much misinformation and just lack of information, honestly, which makes people like you just so valuable and so important. So I want to commend you for the work that you're doing because it's so needed.
Yeah, likewise. I think you're one in a million yourself. So I feel like I'm in good company here. But thank you for that.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. So I think now I'd love to dive into like eating disorders and REDS, so relative energy deficiency in sport. So from your perspective, like what are the biggest myths you encounter about fueling and especially around sports?
I think, several things. If I think about like the myths around REDS in particular, I think there's this belief that we can, just like there is with eating disorders, that we have these ideas of what someone who has an eating disorder looks like or what someone with REDS looks like. Whereas most of the REDS cases, similar to eating disorders, are not thin appearing. They're at a kind of a normal or above expected weight. And so for that reason, I think that's one of the reasons that they're so easily missed. There's a misconception that if you're in a larger body, you need to fuel differently or not fuel as much, or you have the reserves to get through sport and you can eat less. Or there's also just this misconception that everyone can achieve a certain aesthetic as an athlete or that everybody wants to. I think that's really problematic and drives a lot of the disordered eating patterns that we see in sport.
Yeah, I think that idea of like that there's a look for an athlete. Like I always think back to how powerful it is when a coach says like, oh, you look really fit, as in like fitness has a certain look and the goal of athletes should be to achieve this look. And I just think that there's so many problems that come with that. And I think that's also why so many people, like you said, are missed. So I think in my personal experience, one thing that was really impactful for me is that when I was struggling the most during my eating disorder, I went to the doctor for just my regular checkup. And I mean, they like praised me for my weight loss. And I just love to know, like, why do you think so many athletes, whether they're dealing from Reds or eating disorders, are missed by doctors? Because, you know, my low heart rate got like thrown out essentially because they were like, yeah, you're an athlete. Like, that's going to happen. Or like my missed periods were also like dismissed because I was a runner and that showed that I was fit. So I'd love to just get your perspective on that.
I suppose I think of doctors as living in the same world and being subject to the same, I don't know, cultural ideals around weight and shape that we all are. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes it's the low heart rate, like you said, that's kind of just attributed to their athleticism versus malnutrition. Or oftentimes one of the things that's commonly missed is that someone that starts to struggle might not lose weight, but they may just be weight suppressed. They may not be keeping up with their expected weight gains. And that's really easy to miss. So, you know, and not a lot of people are paying close enough attention to the growth charts. And perhaps during puberty, we see someone start to really take these measures to control and manipulate their weight. And we should see them continuing to go up in weight. And so just for all of these reasons, I think it is easily missed. And then, as far as like athleticism, often it's true that weight loss is praised, and it's also getting stronger or leaner is praised. So you don't have people looking for warning signs. You have people kind of celebrating these body changes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think even away from doctor's office, I know that like on my own team, we have people who's like, oh yeah, this is my heart rate. And like, yeah, I haven't had a period. And like those things don't bring up red flags. And I think that's so sad that that's normalized when someone like me, who has been to so many doctors and who has spent like a lot of time in doctor's office and hospitals, like I know that that's a red flag. And for me, that's like, wow, like that's awful that these people may not realize that they're struggling until they reach a crisis point. And for me, that was like, I ended up in the hospital. And I think that's just sad that like we're missing so many people who could get help earlier.
So many. And I think even with Reds being a newer diagnosis, it's not something coaches are still trying to figure out what the female athlete triad was. And I think that's mm-hmm. been, you know, pretty much retired or thought of as a subset of Reds for the last 10 years. So I think it's just, they're juggling a lot of things and they might not have the knowledge or the wherewithal to be able to see this stuff when it comes up, until it's really bad, until, as you said, they're at like a crisis point. Yeah.
Yeah. Definitely the coaches is an interesting point because I feel like coaches have so much power to help athletes and like intervene and even prevent these issues by creating like a healthier environment around body and fueling. And it's even just one of those things where like saying one thing can have a huge impact on an athlete, like saying, hey, you look fit, or like, you know, you don't look fit right now, or like saying comments around food, like you should eat this, not this. And a lot of times coaches aren't getting that education that they need, which, yeah, is definitely a missing point.
It's so hard. And I'm not sure if this was like part of your sport environment, but like the public, not public, but weighing in front of teammates. And I remember a cross country coach giving, kind of sharing this like ideal percent body fat of high-level Olympic runners to the team, you know, as if that's like something they're going to be trying to move towards as like young women, basically. It's just misguided. I think the intentions are good, but it can have downstream effects, like, as you know. It's hard to reach coaches, but it's a challenge. I mean, projects like yours are really, really important for this reason.
Mm-hmm. So I'd love to now talk about the like difference between Reds and eating disorders, because I think there's like a misconception that you have to have an eating disorder to have Reds. So I'd love to just like break that down of like, what is the difference, and like, how do you help families understand the difference when they come in and you say, hey, you might have Reds, and they're like, no, I don't have an eating disorder. Like, I have a healthy relationship with food.
Yeah, it happens. It happens a lot that someone, absolutely. So to back up, the way that I would explain Reds to a parent or someone who is asking is just this idea that there's like a mismatch or discrepancy between what someone is consuming, what someone is intaking, and their energy expenditure. And because of that, they're suffering a whole host of different consequences to their performance and to their health. That is a medical diagnosis. Eating disorders are a psychiatric diagnosis, and restriction can also and usually is a part of an eating disorder diagnosis, but they don't, for example, have to be actively training or exercising to have an eating disorder. And similarly, we have people come in with REDS, athletes come in with REDS who we're not trying to manipulate weight at all. There was no real intentional desire for weight loss. It may just be a knowledge gap. They may not be aware that their needs are upwards of the 4,000 plus, you know, calories per day as an athlete who is training and a kid who is growing and developing. So those are some of the key differences, but you know, sometimes for parents, I'll sum it up by saying that REDS is a medical diagnosis and eating disorders are it's a psychiatric diagnosis.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that's a really good way to look at it. And I think that makes it very much clear that there is overlap, but they are different diagnoses. So now I'd love to talk about like the early warning signs. Like what are signs that you look at that parents can look at, that coaches can look at, that athletes can look at so that they don't have to end up in like a situation where, you know, their bone density is low, they're missing periods. Like how do you find those warning signs before that happens?
Yeah, I suppose it depends on the position that you're in, because I think coaches might pick up on signs differently, like relative to parents or providers. So if I think of someone's pediatrician or care provider, we're usually paying close attention to the growth charts. And this is true for people up to about age 20. If they're falling off their growth curve in terms of weight or height or both, and especially if they're crossing over more than one percentile, we start to get concerned. And usually it's more than that. You are also hopefully asking questions about their eating and energy levels and relationship with food and trying to get a sense of any body dissatisfaction. Mm-hmm. But for coaches, the way that it might show up for them is stress fractures, for example. Mm-hmm. Fracturing and not healing well or refracturing. Blood work, they might have a physical done and come back as anemic or having low testosterone, if we're talking about males, or maybe they're missing periods or their period is delayed or very light. And the coach is able to pick up on that, whether it's through blood work or just some chatter, you know, across mm-hmm. the athlete. I find it's often one of the teammates that ends up ratting out the athlete for not having a period to the coaches. It's rarely like the athlete coming forward for whatever reason. So, you know, depending on their role, they don't have to be super, super aware of all of the signs and symptoms. It would be nice if they were, but they'll see some common themes in their athletes who are underfueling or struggling with that relationship with food, or it even just could be their behavior in the dining hall or when they're traveling and just a lot of resistance or rigidity around what to eat, when to eat, where to eat. And also, of course, like just poor performance. If they're not performing well, really struggling to keep up in practice, and that's a new development, that might give them reason to start asking some questions. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you mentioned like being anemic as maybe being a sign, and I'd love to unpack that a little bit because in my own experience, I think half my team mm-hmm. is taking iron because they yeah. have come back with like low iron. I'm a runner, so it is pretty common. So I'd love to just unpack like how much of that is like it's normal for runners versus, hey, this might be a sign of something else.
Yeah, you make a really good point. And runners, female runners in particular, are kind of a unique population in that I can't think of another sport that requires iron supplementation at such a high prevalence as like cross country or running would. Mm-hmm. Even male runners end up needing to supplement iron, especially if they're more of kind of have like more of a plant-based diet going on. Still, I would think of it as a really powerful indicator of something potentially being wrong, because let's say there are a couple of of reasons female runners are especially at risk, one being female and having blood losses from menstruation, and two, foot strike hemolysis from running. You have a more aggressive iron turnover, and it is really hard. Almost half of cross country runners aren't meeting their needs, their nutrition needs. So it's really hard to hit those aggressive targets for students and people that are just also have to kind of contend with student life and then high mileage on top of it. So it may be a false flag in runners. So let's say we have a handful of runners who are iron deficient and they then go on to supplement with iron. Maybe that fixes the issue, but for many that struggle with REDS or eating disorders, they'll still come back as being a little bit anemic, or these other symptoms will show up. They might have fractures, like stress fractures or some kind of overtraining syndrome is setting in, or their energy levels are suffering, and then we can't just attribute it to anemia, you know. So it's not a diagnostic, but it can be the first flag in female runners. It means that it might be worth doing more digging. Or if you have someone that's routinely taking iron, I would just be curious as to like why, when did that start? Why did that start? What happens if you go off of it? Just taking a little bit of a closer look to make sure that there's some nutritional adequacy going on there. There's enough.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so definitely something to monitor. I'd love to talk about periods because I think there's a really big like stigmatization. I don't know if that's a word, but stigma around periods where, you know, like that isn't something that coaches talk about, especially since a lot of coaches are male. Like it isn't brought up that, hey, this is why it's important to have your period, especially if you're in high school and, you know, you've crossed that like 16-year-old mark. So I'd love to just talk about like why it's important to get your period, you know, the consequences of amenorrhea, especially at a young age in this critical time for like building bone mass.
Yeah. This is especially important in the running community, and it comes up just across sports as well. I'm happy to say that there seems to be a trend now of thinking of the period as like a woman's superpower or a girl's superpower. And it used to be the case, and it still is in some sport environments, that having the period go away is like a sign of effort. It means that you're doing enough, that you're training hard enough for your, you know, for basically, I think of it as early menopause in a way, basically. So one of the reasons it's important, though, to have a monthly regular period without the use of hormonal birth control for those that, you know, don't need birth control is the bone density, as you said. So being able to keep your bones as dense as they can be, especially during these years that are so critical for building bone mass. There comes a point at the 20s where we're not really laying down bone mass aggressively, and the bone turnover rate is higher. We want to try to build bone mass before that time, before that window of opportunity closes. Especially as athletes, because if you see yourself running into the later decades of life or doing any kind of exercise, you don't want to be contending with like fractures and things like that if you can avoid it.
Yeah, definitely. And I think one of the things that's difficult for me with period recovery is that it's not always obvious to see the effects. Like I'm not getting stress fractures right now, but then I think about like, you know, like I've never had a stress fracture, even though I have primary amenorrhea, but I always try to keep in mind, like, I do want to be an athlete for as long as I can. And I don't want to be the person who, you know, falls down the stairs once and like breaks my back or like breaks something because my bone density is low because of what I did in my teenage years.
Yeah, exactly. It's one of those things that we really have to care for, and it'll pay dividends later. I mean, and that's the other thing about bone loss or osteoporosis. It's silent. It's not like people have symptoms per se. And, you know, speaking to your point about why these things are often missed by healthcare providers, not many people are checking labs and bone density in otherwise healthy appearing young athletes. So not without a really compelling reason, like a fracture or some kind of stress injury. So, you know, that's another thing we find we have to really strongly advocate for, is for a lot of our athletes to go get bone density scans done, especially if they've for females have missed a string of periods. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. So now I'd love to talk about like strategies for getting out of, if you're in that hole of underfueling, whether it's because of REDS or eating disorder. Like what strategies have you found are most successful in helping athletes realize that like there is a problem? Because I know that like for me, the hardest part is accepting that there is something wrong, and it's difficult to take that step and say, hey, like I'm going to change something, whether it's eating more, changing how you're eating, incorporating more fats, or dialing back your exercise. So I'd love to understand like how you have that conversation with athletes.
Yeah, I mean, oftentimes by the time they've gotten to me, they know that they have a problem, which and need at least a little, there's some resistance, but maybe they need a little bit less convincing. I would say that really starts with the coaches and having supportive family members that value health over performance and achievement, and also the coaches. You know, a coach who's able to be supportive and help facilitate finding specialized providers, for example, encouraging them to take a break if that's what they need to get healthy and to come back, you know, stronger than ever. And that's not the case across like the coaches that we know. Not all of them are that supportive or would encourage taking a break from sport in order to go to treatment or just to heal, to weight restore. So I think it starts with, as far as getting through to the athletes, supportive family members, supportive coaches, supportive teammates. We have a lot of athletes who fear loss of sponsorship and loss of opportunities if they even disclose that they're struggling with, you know, with anything, basically. So we're very sensitive to that. And, you know, it always helps to have a healthy sport environment. And we have, you know, a big carrot. We have big leverage, which is getting back to sport. Everyone wants to support this athlete in getting back to doing what they love, if that's their goal as well. So I think it really helps when we're working with athletes specifically that we're all rowing in the same direction and we're working toward the same larger goal. I might be much more inclined to value health over performance myself, but nonetheless, like we're at least all moving in the same direction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. I mean, I've really experienced that with my own journey. As I was hospitalized and then I had sports taken away, and that was a huge motivation for me at the beginning of my recovery journey was, okay, I know that I am not able to exercise until I, you know, do my part, eating what I'm supposed to and gaining my health back. And I think that's been such a huge part of my recovery is that I know that I need to do this to do the sports that I love. So I think that is like a powerful motivator.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting that you noticed that too. And I'm curious how you tolerated that time of being taken out of sport.
Yeah, it was definitely difficult because I think it's hard when you have these two parts of you. One part loves sport for, you know, the connections you make and the space that it gives you. And then there is definitely a part of me that my eating disorder took sport away from me in a way and made sport about, you know, calories in, calories out, and it was a way to burn calories. So it was so difficult to take sports away because now you're eating so much more food and, you know, you don't have sports anymore, and also mentally that's just difficult to go through. And I think that comes back to what you said is it's so important to have a supportive group around you. It was like my coaches always checking in and saying, hey, you know, we really miss you and we're really excited for you to come back. But they were obviously always making sure, like, you know, you're not coming back until we get clearance from your doctor. And my doctor was always having conversations. And my parents were always very much like, we know that this sucks for you. And we hate that we have to do this, but this is the situation that we find ourselves in. And then I think that break really showed me like, hey, I didn't exercise for however many months. And like, look at like the world did not end. I'm still here. And I think that really changed my perspective on like rest and not having exercise is like, I love exercise, but like it doesn't have to be this obsessive and compulsive relationship, which I think is definitely difficult as an athlete to understand the difference between disorder versus discipline. And I think that there can definitely be a bit of gray area in there.
That's so true. And I love that point you made about it kind of robbing you of the joy that you used to experience around the sport. That is something that we hear a lot. It becomes more of a grind and obligation, you know, than something that's like joyful or playful or one of those hallmarks of exercise becoming either problematic or just distorted when we're looking through the lens of the eating disorder. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's really shown in the last couple months. A couple months ago, I really struggled again with compulsive exercise where I couldn't go to the gym without getting on the treadmill or getting on the elliptical because I felt like I needed to burn calories. And I think it's just being honest with yourself and realizing, okay, like, am I doing this because like this makes me feel good, or do I do this because I feel like I have to and because I'm scared of what like I have to eat later in the day? So I think it's just important to be honest with yourself and then like ask for help. Like then I would go to my parents and I'd say, hey, like this is what I've been doing and this is my mindset around it, and like I don't want to do this. I don't want my relationship with exercise to be like this.
I love that. And it's also great that you have supportive parents. You're able to be honest with them about like the thoughts and the behaviors. And I think that really helps a lot too. Just having someone to share the unedited thoughts with that's close to you. And, cause the motivations to exercise, they're squirrely and there's sometimes they're mixed. Yes. It helps with mood. It helps with sleep. And there's also this underlying like a desire to change the body, change the shape. Hard to tease the two apart, but I'm glad that you had that period of tolerating or learning to tolerate rest too, which is such an important muscle to build, you know, for lack of a better word. So yeah.
Yeah. So now I'd love to go more into like the nutrition and its intersection with performance. So as we know, like social media is huge right now, and there definitely is most of the information on there, I would say, is probably something that athletes shouldn't even be looking at. But how can athletes tell the difference between like what's real and what they should listen to versus harmful trends, especially with the rise of like skinny talk and there being so many fitness influencers, you know, telling them to do their detox and telling them how they should lose weight?
Gosh, I'd say the thing that a lot of my athletes find to be really grounding is really trying to center performance over appearance at all times. So I'll ask them questions in terms of just like their social media hygiene. Who are you drawn to and why? What is it about this particular athlete's testimonial on social media that's so moving for you, that's so compelling for you? Is it about the way that they look? You know, can we find someone that you're more kind of attracted to because of their aspects of their performance or their skill? Just unpacking that with them a little bit can be helpful. And also just continually highlighting that because someone is an influencer, it doesn't mean that they have the experience or credentials to be able to give sound advice. What's popular isn't always right. So it's just trying to bring them back to like looking at the science too. If they're research savvy, we can talk about how to find peer-reviewed articles and to kind of sift through the science to learn a little bit more about how to meet their needs and sports nutrition. Just some other red flags, like a big following without the credentials, if we're talking about like a fitness influencer, for example, or someone who claims to be like a healer of some sort but doesn't have any of that formal training. Extreme examples of how to eat that require eliminating whole groups of foods. That's always a red flag. Promising really rapid, aggressive weight loss over a short period of time is a red flag. So, you know, those more measured voices don't tend to get the likes on social media, but those are the ones that we tend to be able to really benefit from and grow from. So it's just kind of thinking about how to make that environment for you on social media a little bit more like healthy and grounded. Or you can follow ACSM, for example, the American College of Sports Medicine, or NIH, or another group that you admire or value that has some ties with sports nutrition, British Journal of Sports Medicine. And a lot of that is geared toward professionals, but it can also be super helpful for athletes. And, you know, because you don't know what you don't know. So if we can mm-hmm. use a good, healthy, reliable source of information, it's a starting point anyway. We always try to help our athletes become savvy consumers of literature and media. Supplement industry is one of those things that's totally out of control and hard to navigate. So mm-hmm. can we help them become safe and savvy consumers of supplements too?
I just think it's so important to be like conscious of like what you're consuming, like on social media. Like it's so easy, I feel like, to just get lost in the algorithm and like keep scrolling. And I think another really big red flag for me when I have a post is the body checks, because I think they can be so like deceiving, and that like you might not think it's like harmful content when in reality the underlying message is, hey, if you eat like me, this is what you're going to look like. And I just think it's important to realize that, like, yeah, if we all ate the same and we all exercised the same, like, we would look different, and everyone has their own needs. So I think that's also a really helpful reminder for me, is to always think, like, you know, as cheesy as it sounds, like, you just can't compare yourself to the 1% that someone's posting on social media.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the body diversity is, it's a gift, and it's not something that we spend enough time talking about or embracing. But as you said, if we all ate the same, we wouldn't all look the same. We would all still have different shapes. We'd be different shapes and sizes. And also, we don't know what they're really doing behind the scenes. There's a chance that they're eating and exercising exactly the way as they're portraying, and there's probably a bigger chance that they're not. And in either case, it's not for us to figure out. So I would say, just in general, when it comes to really like appealing sports nutrition advice, performance advice from folks online, the more measured, the more thoughtful voice is usually going to be the one that at least I would be drawn to, and I would try to draw my athletes to as well. Versus the more salacious.
Yeah, definitely. So I'd love to know, like, what are the most common fueling mistakes you see in athletes, whether it's like a high school, recreational, elite athletes?
I would say big one is relying on supplements when they're not dialed in with their nutrition in so many ways. And when I was working for a D1 school here as a sports dietitian, I think the thing that I talked about the most was eating before practice in the morning, drinking something, even if eating is not happening, at least like a chocolate milk or whatever they could get their hands on, whatever they could tolerate. But there was like this desire. I think athletes are often drawn toward figuring out a supplement regimen before they have their meals, and snacks even just in place. Regular eating at regular intervals is really underrated and undervalued. So trying to think of, can we meet the needs through the food first is one of those things that I think athletes have a hard time embracing. Swept up in the promises that are offered by like many of the supplement manufacturers. So.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And I think it's like just so easy to like go and get your magnesium and your iron and your calcium like right from the pharmacy, instead of looking at like, hey, can I get this from my snacks and my meals? And I think especially being a student athlete, it can be like really difficult to make sure that you are getting in all your snacks that you need to in the day, with busy schedules, and obviously school takes so much time, and it's not always easy to like fit your fueling around that. So I think that's also really important.
Yeah, exactly. Like the logistics, they don't make it easy. That's for sure. And to your point, you usually can meet your needs through food, with some exceptions. For example, like the iron issue in runners is a really common one, and sometimes there's just no way through that other than supplementation. But in most other cases, we can totally meet the needs through the diet. And oftentimes, once we get squared away there, the need for the supplement just falls off. There's no benefit to it. There's no point in taking it, no point in buying it. So that can be nice and empowering too, I think, for an athlete to know that like they're doing everything that they can. Labs are looking good. They're feeling good. They know that they're eating enough. Yeah, I would say that is the biggest one, though, is just maybe underestimating their needs and how high their needs really are, especially youth and young adult athletes who are training, you know, year round, several days per week.
Yeah, definitely. And then just as a final wrap up question, I'd love to just know, like, for a young high school athlete who's out there, like, what is the biggest piece of advice that you could give them around this topic of fueling and sports?
Get guidance from someone that you feel that you can trust, that has the experience, and try not to be swept up by media and things that you see online and on TV and things like that. I would say just try to find someone that you trust and learn how to feed yourself and fuel yourself appropriately early on, because that will pay dividends in college and beyond. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And if you're struggling, ask for help is the only way. Try not to solve these issues in a tunnel, you know, by yourself. Just ask for help. That could be a parent, a coach, if you feel like you can trust them and that they would be a good and healthy support. But I would keep those two things in mind. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I love that. And I think that's a great message to leave off today. So again, I just want to thank you so much for coming on. This was a great conversation.
It was a delight to chat with you. And thank you so much for having me. Stay in touch if you can.
Sounds good.
Hey. Okay.